So tonight's talk is called The Benefits of Restraint. And I want to start by saying in our culture that sounds like an oxymoron, right? Restraint and benefits just don't seem to fit in the same sentence too easily. But this was a quite a important theme of the Buddha and how he taught, particularly how he taught monastics. But I want to do what I can to relate this to this being householders and how this fits in quite nicely with householder life as well. And before I actually read some pieces of the sutta, this is based on something called Errors in Dhamma from Majjhima Nikaya number 3. Before I do that, even I want to just give you a little bit of context for what you're about to hear. Part of the monastic rule was that bhikkhus and bhikkhunis only ate one meal a day, and they had to eat that meal before noon. So they would go on their rounds, their dhana rounds, in the morning, and people in the village would give them food. But they had to eat it all before noon. And then they didn't eat again till the next day. And they're not, part of that was also they weren't allowed to grow food, save food for later on in the day, sort of thing, or for the next day even. They just had to, like, every day they were totally dependent on the householders, the villagers around where they were staying. And so that's the context for how this starts. And he starts out, the Buddha's talking about that how the bhikkhus are his heirs in the Dhamma. They were going to continue on his teaching. They were his heirs. And this is what he was giving them in a sense, or what they would take with, after he was gone, what they had. And so this is starting, and he's going to use this story to point out this to them. Now, bhikkhus, suppose that I had eaten, refused more food, had my fill, finished, had enough, had what I needed, and some alms food was left over to be thrown away. This is what they did. If they had anything left over after they'd gathered around, they would put it someplace where it didn't cause any problems. Then two bhikkhus arrived, hungry and weak, and I told them, "Bhikkhus, I have eaten, had what I needed, but there is this alms food of mine left over to be thrown away. Eat if you like. If you do not eat, then I shall throw it away where there is no greenery, or drop it into water where there is no life." Then one bhikkhu thought, "The blessed one has eaten, has had what he's needed, but there is this alms food of the blessed one left over to be thrown away." This is like the blessed one's food. This is like special, right? "If we do not eat it, the blessed one will throw it away. But this has been said of the blessed one, 'Bhikkhus, be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things.' Now this alms food is one of the material things. Suppose that instead of eating this alms food, I pass the night and day hungry and weak." And instead of eating that alms food, he passed the night and day hungry and weak. Then the second bhikkhu thought, "The blessed one has eaten, had what he needed, but there is this alms food, the blessed one left over to be thrown away. Suppose that I eat this alms food and pass the night and day neither hungry nor weak." And after eating that alms food, he passed the night neither hungry nor weak. Now, although that bhikkhu, by eating that alms food, passed the night and day neither hungry nor weak, yet the first bhikkhu is more to be respected and commended. So the bhikkhu who didn't eat was restrained, right? Why is that? Because that will long for long conduce to his fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, easy support and arousal of energy. Therefore, bhikkhus, be my heirs in the Dhamma, not my heirs in material things. Out of compassion for you, I have thought, how shall my disciples be my heirs in Dhamma, not my heirs in material things? So this is the story. And the Buddha has eaten, he has some leftovers, and then these two guys come and they haven't eaten, but it's past the time when people should eat, okay? And they didn't participate in the alms round. And one guy said, "No, I have to follow the rules, essentially. I have to be an heir to the, this is just a material thing. I can live without this. I can restrain myself for a day and wait till tomorrow to eat." And the other guy ate. Here's the interesting thing. First of all, when I first heard this story, when I first read this story, I was like, well, that seems kind of odd. I mean, they're gonna, what he's saying is you should throw that food away because it's like, not the proper time to eat anymore. It's like wasting food, which I grew up in a household where my father, who was a POW for 2 years, and the one thing you never did in my household was waste food. It was like the ultimate, the bad thing to do. And so I have this sort of reflexive thought about this. But it's the bhikkhu who chooses to do this, to restrain, to not eat, that gets the praise of the Buddha. But, and this is interesting, he praises the one who doesn't eat, but he doesn't sort of, blame and wag his finger at the guy who did. It wasn't like, he didn't sort of, diss this guy. He just sort of said, this is praiseworthy, not having not eaten. But what's interesting is as he's doing this, he lists, this is, here's another list hidden away here. He says, because that will long conduce to his fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, easy support, and arousal of energy. So these are the five benefits of restraint. Hence the title of my talk, right? So what I want to do is spend some time looking at these five benefits and then putting that into context for not bhikkhus like us. I mean, people who aren't monastics. But so the list, once again, fewness of wishes, contentment, effacement, easy support, and arousal of energy. So the first one is fewness of wishes, right? Well, this is right embedded in the second noble truth. The craving, the cause of all our suffering. We want something, we wish for something, then all of a sudden we need something. It isn't just a wish anymore, it turns into a need. And then if we're not careful, all of a sudden it's a must have. I gotta have it, and I gotta have it right now. This is the process the mind goes through from just having this sort of wish, oh, it would be nice to have food today, in the case of this bhikkhu, to, well, we started thinking, he started thinking of all the reasons they're going to waste the food. It's silly. This was the blessed one's food. So it's like blessed, special food. But he didn't do it. So I want to actually share something about this from one of Joseph Goldstein's book, Mindfulness. And basically, what he's saying here, this is a section on craving, a favorite topic of the Buddha and of Joseph, and I suppose of me as well. Craving doesn't deliver lasting happiness, is the heading here. First, sense pleasures don't, in the end, deliver on their promise of happiness. We believe the experience of sense pleasures will bring us happiness because of the pleasant feeling that arise. And they do bring some happiness for a time. The problem is that pleasant feelings are very impermanent, sometimes momentarily so. They continually change and disappear. So we go after another and another, and all too soon our lives are at an end. It's like trying to quench our thirst by drinking salt water. It only makes us thirstier. How many sense pleasures, pleasant feelings, have we already enjoyed in our lives? Countless ones. And we never come to a sense of completion. We're always waiting for, anticipating the next one. How much of our lives and energy do we want to invest in this endless pursuit? Although most of us are lay people living in and engaged with the world of sense pleasures to some degree or another, some deep part of us knows that this is not the way to peace. Dharma practice opens us to the possibilities of much greater happiness in our lives. The second danger is that when craving becomes strong and powerful force in the mind, it can lead us to many unwholesome actions, creating more unskillful karma, which results in suffering. Craving plays a pivotal role in the teachings of dependent inner origination. Based on contact and feeling, whether pleasant or unpleasant, craving arises. Because of craving, clinging arises, etc. This is the teachings on the 12 steps of codependent arising. And this is like a cycle we go through over and over and over again. An idiomatic way of expressing these links might bring home just how common and familiar they are to us. I want, I need, I must have. How many times have we gone from a simple wanting, a desire, to that convincing mind state of needing? Right there, we have gone from craving to clinging. As the felt need gets stronger, it turns into must have. This is already on the cusp of action, of becoming. Pay attention during the day to this sequence. It could happen with a very little thing or a more major one. I want a cookie. I need a cookie. I must have a cookie. And off we go. I'm going to tell you, this is a little personal, so I experienced this, and I had to really work with this. I used to, this is, I when I lived up in Canada, so over 20 years ago, I had a allotment garden, but I had to drive to get to the allotment garden. And the allotment garden, to get there, I drove right by a Tim Hortons donut shop. Now, if you don't know what a Tim Hortons donut shop is, it's like the Canadian equivalent of Krispy Kreme or something, right? It's like the best donuts. And it's like I would find myself driving to the garden, and I would be driving past, and all of a sudden, I'd be there at the counter ordering a donut. I wouldn't have planned this. I would just like automatically there I'd be caught in this loop of, Oh, look, there's the donut shop. Well, I think maybe I should stop. Oh, I really need a donut. I better build up my strength before I go work in the garden. It was like, it just happens all the time. This is how we do. We have this little idea, wouldn't it be nice if, that turns into, well, yeah, I think I should, to I really need. It's like, it's good for me, right, to have two Boston cream donuts and a cup of coffee from Tim Hortons. I'm going to Canada tomorrow, so I'm thinking about it already. Anyhow, it's an interesting way to think about how we fall into this cycle over and over and over again. And at the time of actually, you know, getting that donut and biting into that donut, it made me happy. It was always did. It was like they're really good donuts, if you like that sort of thing. But then it was gone, just like that. And this is the problem with thinking that satisfying our needs, our wants, our wishes makes us happy. Because think about what actually happens. I'm sitting here right now thinking, oh, at the airport in Toronto, they have this Tim Horton place just as you come out of customs. You know, I'm already thinking about this in my mind. It's incredible, right? And it's like, but because it's not there yet, it's like I want something, but I don't have it. Unhappy. I can't, it's like that's what happens. We want something, but we can't have it yet. Then we're unhappy because we don't have it yet. Then we actually get it. Yeah, that actually getting it often is wonderful. It's sweet. It's happy. Whatever it is you're getting. Then it's gone. And you're unhappy again. This is not an effective way. And when two out of the three time periods of desire are times when we're not happy because it's either we haven't got it yet or it's gone. This is not a smart way to make ourselves happy. But we keep falling into this all the time, in little ways and big ways. Wanting a donut, wanting a new job, wanting a new partner, wanting new whatever. Something better. That's gonna make me happy for sure. So fewness of wishes, restraining our habit of indulging in those wishes. Not all the time. I mean, I'm telling you, I'm gonna go to Tim Horton and get a donut when I'm in Toronto. It's like I'm gonna be honest with you. But I only do it once. It's not like every day I don't have to go and get another one. Just so you have to sort of be gentle with yourself, but you have to sort of go, oh, do I really need that? Just that moment of restraint of like, do I really need to do this? Do I really need to satisfy that wish? And letting go and going, no, not really. It's not going to solve any problems for me. And so this is like the first of this list of five things that the Buddha said. By practicing restraint, we reduce how often wishes arise. That's the benefit of restraint. By practicing restraint, it's less likely that that next wish that comes along will catch us, because we're used to, no, I don't need all that stuff. Okay. Second one on this list is contentment. This is a I used to run a yoga center, and we called it Santosha Yoga, and Santosha means contentment in Sanskrit. Back in the day. And so this was a big theme for us and has been for a long time for me. And this is just being happy with what you have, being content with what you have now, not feeling that I gotta have more stuff, right? There's this great thing about the Buddha said. The Buddha said that two things are remarkably rare in this world. People who benefit others and people who feel gratitude. And gratitude and contentment are very tightly linked together. If we have gratitude for what we already have, and think how lucky we are to have all this stuff we have. I mean, it's incredible. We live in this really rich place where everybody, we have a turn on the tap and water comes out, and we plug something in and the electricity's on, and all these things that we just sort of take for granted, that most of the world don't take for granted at all, or don't have at all for that matter. So having gratitude is something we want to cultivate, because it brings about contentment. And I want to read something about gratitude. This is from book called The Book of Joy, which is a set of dialogues between the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu. And they're talking about gratitude and the importance of gratitude. And this is, remember, this is them talking, and then the person who wrote this book, Douglas Abrams, is sort of filling in the blanks. He's sort of taking their dialogue and fitting it into a context. So neither the Archbishop nor the Dalai Lama spent a great deal of time talking about enjoyment. Perhaps because both of their traditions are skeptical of finding lasting happiness through sensual indulgence. But I had been happy to find that neither of them was opposed to the pleasures permitted in their spiritual lives, whether it was Tibetan rice pudding or rum raisin ice cream. Gratitude is the elevation of enjoyment. Gratitude is the elevation of enjoyment. I love this phrase. The ennobling of enjoyment. Gratitude is the recognition of all that holds us in the web of life, and that all that has made it possible to have the life that we have and the moment that we are experiencing. Thanksgiving is a natural response to life and maybe the only way to savor it. Both Christian and Buddhist traditions, perhaps all spiritual traditions, recognize the importance of gratefulness. It allows us to shift our perspective, as the Dalai Lama and the Archbishop counseled, toward all we have been given and all that we have. It moves us away from the narrow-minded focus on fault and lack and the wider perspective of benefit and abundance. You know, it moves us away from the, it's not fair that I don't have X. It's not fair, you know, which is deeply embedded in our culture these days. And then the Dalai Lama goes on here. The Dalai Lama's ability to be grateful for the opportunities that exist, even in exile, was a profound shift in perspective, allowing him not only to accept the reality of his circumstances, but also to see the opportunity in every experience. I mean, the Dalai Lama, back in 1959, I believe, had to flee Tibet. He was the spiritual leader of the entire country, and he had to get out of Dodge, because he was going to be arrested and thrown in jail. And he had to literally flee through the Himalayas to northern India. And, you know, he had to give up everything that he had. He had a palace and everything. It was like he was like the big cheese, right? Acceptance means not fighting reality. That's another. Acceptance means not fighting reality. Gratitude means embracing reality. It means moving from counting your burdens to counting your blessings, as the Archbishop had recommended, both as an antidote to envy and as a recipe for appreciating our own lives. It's another great line, eh? You move from counting your burdens to counting your blessings. It's just a shift in perspective, a shift in mental process. That's all it is. And it makes you, it restrains your habit of wanting to satisfy all your wishes. Next one, effacement. So first of all, I came to this word effacement and I went, what the heck does that mean? I didn't know. I actually looked it up. I had to look it up in the dictionary. So, because it's not, you don't see it used in normal day-to-day conversation too much. So what does effacement mean? The act of, this is from Merriam-Webster, okay? The act or process of effacing or eliminating something. Reduction to insignificance. Sometimes also translated as relinquishing. So this is once again consciously choosing to do away with the habits of wishing and satisfying those wishes. And in this sutta there are sections in another sutta, which I have to now get the right page, where where the Buddha talks about giving up and what effacement really means. And these are the inclinations of mind that lead you to effacement. Even, and said, even, this is the Buddha. He's talking to someone named Kunda. I say that even the inclination of mind towards wholesome states is of great benefit. So, what could be said about bodily and verbal acts conforming to such a state of mind? So, just inclining, even thinking about having the inclination towards not of restraining is a benefit. And how much greater is it if you actually do it? Actually, consciously make this part of your practice. Because this is a practice, of course, just like everything else. And then the next one of these is avoidance. Suppose there was an uneven path and another even path by which to avoid it. And suppose there were an uneven ford and another even ford by which to avoid it. So once again, it's like you can, which road do you take? If I tried hard, I probably could have found a way to drive to my garden without driving past the Tim Hortons donut shop. Might have taken me a little longer, but I could have done that. But I was like, it was just like, oh boy, I get to get, that's what we do. So we have to look and see, is there a different route I can take, whether this is physical or mental route that I can take where I don't even encounter that thing that's so tempting that I want so much. And then the final one, and this is this is another way, and he's talking about helping others and how helping others helps us not want things. It's really interesting, what he says here. That one who is himself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is impossible. That one who is not himself sinking in the mud should pull out another who is sinking in the mud is possible. So if you're not caught yourself, you can help others not be caught. Right? That one who is himself untamed, undisciplined, extinguished, should tame another disciple, discipline himself. So it's like if we're not restrained ourselves, how can we help others lead a life of restraint? It's something to think about. I mean, I was this reminds me of a conversation I had today. I was at the hospital today talking to a fellow chaplain, and we were talking about, given what's happened in the last couple of days in this country, what can I do? What can I do? And I was saying to him, I thought about this a lot. I said, the only thing I can do is keep doing my practice and as much as possible be a source of calm and quiet and loving kindness in the world. That's all I can do. And if that helps a little bit out there in the craziness of the world, that's then I've done my duty. And I've helped someone else not get stuck in the mud, maybe. Using the metaphor that the Buddha was using here. So it's interesting, but that's a way to extinguish wants, is to help others instead. Just put our energy in a different direction. It's an interesting thought, huh? Okay. Then the fourth of these is easy support. So, yeah, I have to understand that the monks, as I said earlier, are totally supported by householders. This was built into the Buddhist system to keep the monks from getting uppity, basically. If the monks got uppity, the householders didn't feed them. They starved. So they didn't have any choice. They were really dependent. And then, of course, the monks, on the other hand, helped the villagers in certain ways, through ceremonial things, but also through things like nursing the sick. So one of the duties of the monks was to help the villagers who were sick. So if you're easy to support, if you make it easy on the villagers to support you, don't demand. I mean, there's all these stories about monks who, well, you know, that stuff you just put in my bowl doesn't have enough chilies in it. Sort of, it's like being demanding, wanting some ex special treatment, something extra. And this was considered very improper, of course. So to be easy to support is a gift to the villagers. It means that the householders makes it can still support the monks, but they don't have to. It doesn't sort of complicate their lives any more than necessary. But what does this mean for us as householders ourselves? And we're not monastics. I think this means that we have to find ways to live in the world that place as little burden as possible on others. Can we do things so that we're not a burden on other people? Both physically, but also mentally, emotionally, think of all the ways we can burden other people. And this is directly related to fewness of wishes and contentment. But there's a but here. Not wanting to be any trouble can actually bring more trouble. People, and you see this, oh, I didn't want to bother you with that. And because they didn't want to bother you with that, now you have to, go back and fix something that should have been done 2 weeks ago. But and you see this with parents and children. Oh, I didn't want to bother you with that. And you see it the other way around, for that matter. My kid should just be having fun. Didn't want to bother them with that. In relationships, there's people who do this all the time. I didn't want to bother anybody with that. And it becomes like a martyr complex in some sense, but it also creates all kinds of friction and difficulty, and often creates situations that are much more complicated and troublesome than if they had bothered you, said something at the appropriate time. It's a cultural thing that we see that we have to be very aware of, that sometimes actually being a little bit of trouble for someone else allows them to give you something. Shift how you think about these things. It's like you're allowing someone to be generous and kind towards you can actually be quite a kind thing to do. If you let it be, if you don't make it into a demand, it's like, it's and there's that fine ground there. Finally, number five on this list. Arousal of energy. Having restraint, not having to have too much of anything, not having to have too much stuff, all those things we've been talking about, gives us more energy. We have more energy to practice, more energy to do the things we have to do in the world. And there's the Pali word virya that often is translated as energy, but it's also translated as effort. And these are sort of like two sides of the coin, right? And this is something that the Buddha talks about all the time. Right effort, or wholesome effort, the sixth step on the Eightfold Path. It's the virya is also the third of the seven factors of awakening. And restraint is a way to arouse energy, which can be channeled into the practice. Classically, on retreat, for instance, on longer retreats, I've talked before about, the five precepts, of how living a wholesome life. On retreat, you are offered the chance to add three more precepts. Not adorning yourself in any way. No perfumes, no jewelry, no nothing. Just no fancy clothes, just like really simple life. And not eating after the noon meal. Now they're saying now it's like you have lunch, so it's like in for monastics it had to be before noon. And so they're a little, well, you can have lunch at noon because that's when lunch is served, but after that you don't eat. And not having any sort of luxurious living situation. The actual phrasing is not having a high and luxurious bed, which was like, for a monastic would be, oh my God, something way too fancy. Just to, sleep on the ground, basically. This is, it's a really interesting practice to do this. It's sort of like the thing that goes on. It's still back in my hippie days, fasting was a big deal. People fasting for a day or fasting for 2 days or whatever was like, it was restraint and it was like cleansing and really healthy and very sort of spiritual, right? But it's not eating after the noon meal when you're practicing means that during that, at that time when everybody else is going off to eat, you've got this, oh, look, I've got an, I can sit, I can do another sitting period here. And then later on in the evening, because you didn't eat the evening meal, you have more energy and you sit longer in the evening as well. It's a very straight line relationship. So adding that little bit of restraint just means you have more time for practice. And I found when I did this, because I did this several times on long retreats, it gives you an enormous amount of energy. Just that bit of restraint. You think, oh my God, you're skipping a whole meal. You're going to be really exhausted. But actually, because I'm not spending all that energy digesting food and spending all that time to get it and clean up afterwards and all that sort of stuff, you ended up with more energy than actually having the meal. It surprised me when I, because I like to eat, I'm to be honest with you. And I, when I, on my several, re first several retreats, I was like, oh, well, that's for those holy people. I don't, it's not me. I got to have my three squares a day. And then 1 year I just thought, oh, I'm going to try this out. And then after that, almost every retreat I did, every long retreat I did, I just went on, took that precept and didn't eat after the noon meal. And it just gives you way more energy. It's just interesting how this works, is what I guess is what I'm pointing to. Joseph Goldstein, of course, has a few things to say about this too. He's talking about this virya, this energy, and he's talking about the different meanings it sometimes has, which is sort of related to what I've been talking. We can get a sense of the many nuances of virya from the different ways this Pali term has been translated into English. It has been translated variously as energy, effort, strength, courage, vigor, perseverance, and persistence. Each one of these words points to a different facet of the Pali term. In the most basic meaning of energy, virya is the capacity for activity, the power to do something. This energetic capacity, the power to do, manifests in a variety of ways. Strength. One function of energy is to shore things up, like reinforcing a levee in times of a flood. So this is just like energy gives you the strength to do something important. Courage. Another aspect of virya, one that might not be immediately associated with energy and strength, is that of courage. There is a quality that powerfully energizes our heart as we walk on the path. While the nature of sloth and torpor is to retreat from difficulties, the nature of courage is the opposite. Courage is energized by challenges. It is inspired by difficult tasks and even seeks them out. When courage is present, we rise to meet different challenges for the sake of what we want to accomplish. and we're not discouraged by thought of hardship or by the length of the undertaking. When still a bodhisattva striving for Buddhahood, Siddhartha made the following well-known resolve: "Let only my skin and sinews and bones remain, and let my flesh and blood in the body dry up. I shall not permit the course of my efforts to stop until I win that which may be won by human ability, human effort, and human exertion." Now, this is an extreme image, but it's this what the Buddha did. He said, I'm going to do this. And it was courageous, because what he was doing was, you know, still considered extreme. But also, it's like he left home, he was all by himself, living in the forest, and he decided he was going to do it anyway. But, there's always a but, here's another but. Understanding different nuances of virya, energy, strength, courage, brings us to the thorny problem of understanding the relationship between all of these qualities and effort. What is effort? When is it balanced? When is it counterproductive? Effort is an expenditure of energy to accomplish some objective. But the word effort in English has so many connotations, we need to carefully examine its skillful application and practice. To do that, we will first look at its unskillful applications. Effort can become unskillful when there is a forcing of mind, what I call efforting, rather than a relaxation of mind. Effort becomes unskillful when there's some idea of gain and a mind full of expectations, rather than an openness and receptivity to whatever is already there. So this is when we practice because we want something. We decide, this is something we read in a book, or something someone told us, or whatever. It's like, that's what I want. And now you're practicing to make that happen, as opposed to relaxing back and letting whatever arises be what arises and happen. And then Joseph goes through this long story about how he got caught in this. Finally, after all the time, I let go of wanting and settled back with acceptance into what was presenting itself. And although the body of light didn't return in the same way, so he had this experience where his body was this pure light. And then he kept practicing to make it happen again. This is something that everybody I know who's been in this practice for a while gets caught in a place like this. We've experienced something totally amazing, something totally beyond our whatever we've experienced before. And it's like, wow, I want that to happen again. And then we start practicing to make it happen. And that's when we get caught. Right? And although the body of light didn't return in the same way, there was an easeful flow of phenomena arising and passing in each moment. I realized that I'd been dragging around the corpse of previous experience. Isn't that a great phrase? The corpse of previous experience. Trying to reclaim something that had changed and passed. The lesson here is that we need to be mindful of how we're making effort. If there's a strong agenda, the in order to mind I've spoken of, being aware in order for something in particular to happen, or if we're holding on to the object too tightly, afraid we'll lose it, then we need to open and relax the mind, softening the quality of our effort. On the other hand, if the mind is continually drifting off and there's no effort to investigate what's going on, then we need to strengthen effort factor. So it's this balance between too much and too little. And this is there's all kinds of famous images of the Buddha uses to talk about this idea that we're having to find this balance all the time of too much effort and not enough, and knowing when those things are there, actually being mindful enough to see that. It's not easy. So basically, at the end, the sutta ends up saying that all that is, oh, this is important because it leads to being happy in seclusion. Being happy in seclusion, which is from the bhikkhu's point of view, since they live a life of seclusion mainly, traditionally, to be happy there is really important. Nothing worse than practicing and being unhappy all the time at the same time. But what does it mean for us as householders? It means really looking at how we live and seeing if we can lead a really simple, quiet life. Can I simplify my life to make it quieter and simpler? Less, I don't need as much, I don't want as much. I can let things go, I can have some restraint. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't enjoy life. In fact, this brings happiness, right? That's the whole thing. This is like the benefits of this restraint is it makes you happier. It seems contradictory almost, but that's the balance that we're trying for. And so us as householders, just looking at our life and going, do I need to do this? Do I need all this stuff? Do I need to do this thing? Do I need to go on this vacation? Do I need to do whatever it is we're thinking of doing? And finding balance. And I'm not saying vacations are bad or having going out for a nice meal is bad or anything. All those pleasures are wonderful things. It's just trying to find that balance so that we have more energy to practice, which is really what this whole sutta is about. So it's like, can we have more time, energy, this willingness to go deeper into the practice? That's what this whole thing is about. And it's just the mind, that's the benefit of restraint. I'll finish this with a little bit of poetry, of course. This is from Mary Oliver's book, Evidence. It's called Hallelujah. Everyone should be born into this world happy and loving everything. But in truth, it rarely works that way. For myself, I've spent my life clamoring toward it. Hallelujah. Anyway, I'm not where I started. Have you too been trudging like that, sometimes almost forgetting how wondrous the world is and how miraculously kind some people can be? And have you too decided that nothing important is ever easy? Not, say, for the first 60 years. Hallelujah, I'm 60 now, and even a little more, and some days I feel like I have wings. I can go for that.